Hello, my name is Barbara Knight, and I want to welcome you to this teleseminar on designing a mail center. Today I will be speaking with Mark Fallon, President and CEO of the Berkshire Company, about how designing a mail center impacts you and your company. If you have any questions during this teleseminar, please email them to me at questions@berkshire-company.com. Again, the email address is questions@berkshire-company.com. In addition to covering the prepared remarks, we'll answer as many of those questions as time allows. So let's get started. Mark, please provide an overview of what we will be discussing today.
Barb, today, first we're going to start with the principles and concepts of design, and that's really going to emphasize workflow and how you manage that. Then we're going to go over the type of equipment that's available to help you create an excellent mail center. From there, we're going to actually share examples from either past engagements as consultants or things that we did as managers to help improve our mail centers. And lastly, we'll provide some resources for our listeners both today and then later on for the downloads that they'll get next week.
What are the principles and concepts that you refer to?
Well, the very first concept, as I mentioned earlier, is workflow. And workflow means how to best process your work. A lot of people think of workflow as a clear definition of this is what we do. We consider workflow as what should you be doing to best process your work. Next, we're going to cover ergonomics, which is how to process your work efficiently, both for you and your employees. Then safety, how do you keep your employees safe in the environment that they work? Often overlooked when we're talking about mail center design, but very important, not just because of potential threats in the mail, but even just day-to-day how to keep your employees safe. And then lastly, we're going to talk about security, which includes your people. It includes the property, both the operations property as well as personal property, and the information that you process. Mail centers are really information processing centers, and we need to make sure that we keep our customers' and our clients' information safe and secure.
When you say workflow, what exactly do you mean?
Well, workflow is how you get your work done. It's the steps that you take to process the documents you receive and deliver internally if you're an inbound operation, or it's the steps you take for the documents you produce and then deliver to the U.S. Postal Service, or perhaps that you deliver to other carriers. When you're talking about workflow, you want to make sure that you take advantage of how people naturally work. So, for example, whenever possible, workflow should be clockwise or left to right. Why is that? Well, because most people are right-handed. Approximately 7% of the population is left-handed, and it will be slightly more difficult for them. However, for 93% of us, we're right-handed, so it's very natural for us to move left to right. Also, in the Western Hemisphere, we read left to right. So, again, it's natural for people's eyes to move in that left to right process. And clockwise, when you look at it, is that left to right. So, whenever possible, your physical workflow should be clockwise and should be left to right. When you're considering workflow, you also have to think about where you're doing the work. So you want to make sure that you place the work areas in a proximity, the appropriate proximity, to the entrance and the exit. For example, for inbound mail, you want to be able to start working on it as soon as you receive it. So your initial sort tables, your rough sort tables, your dump tables, the sign-in sheets for the Postal Service or UPS or FedEx should be as close to the entrance of the mail center as possible. You want to limit how many people come into the mail center. We'll talk about that more with security. But again, you can start working on the mail as soon as it comes in. You're not taking extra time to wheel the mail down to the far end of the mail center or wheel the mail down to another room. Your mail center should be as close to the entrance as possible. Likewise, when you're designing your mail center for the outbound side, your final processing center should be as close to the exit as possible. That may mean that your metering operation is close to the exit if you're just metering mail. If you're sorting mail, well, the sorter should be the one that's closest to the exit. If you're doing more work, for example, we had clients that were preparing mail through AMPS. The final processing for the pallets was right next to the exit. So you want to make sure that as you design that process, it ends close to the exit, so you're not taking extra time moving finished work from, say, the far right-hand corner all the way back to the exit. You also want, when you're considering workflow, to separate functions into different areas. In other words, you should have one area that's dedicated to your inbound mail processing, and yet another area dedicated to your outbound mail processing. You should separate the rough sort of your mail from the fine sort of your mail. On the outbound side, you should have a separate area for prepping the documents, whether that's hand inserting, machine insertings, and then a separate area for shipping and metering. Now, some of our clients have very small operations and they have small shops, so they can't dedicate whole areas of wall space or dedicate entire areas of room. However, they can separate by that fourth dimension, which is time. So in other words, a specific table from the hours of 7:30 a.m. to noon will only be used for processing inbound mail. Then in the afternoon, from 1 o'clock to 6 o'clock, it'll be used for processing outbound mail. But again, you want to make sure you separate what it is you're processing. And the why is pretty easy, because you don't want to confuse what's supposed to be happening with a piece of mail. I've seen this as a supervisor and as a manager, people actually take mail that was coming in, and then because it was placed in an area that's mostly for outbound mail, what happened to it? It gets scooped up and put in the tray for outbound mail. So it's really important that you separate your work by what's going on to it. And if you don't have the space, use that fourth dimension of time to separate your work.
What is the definition of ergonomics, and why is this important to consider when designing a mail center?
Well, ergonomics actually comes from the Greek words ergon, which means work, and nomos, which means rules. So ergonomics literally means work rules. Now, for those of us of a certain age, most people actually became familiar with the term ergonomics in the late 1990s. And that was because that's when PCs became prevalent. It's when, you know, keyboarding and repetitive stress injuries caused by keyboarding became more popular. It's when you started to see people with arm splints or whatever. And companies started to realize that you needed to set the work rules to go further to actually space rules. And that's when most of us became familiar with ergonomics. However, within factories, ergonomics has been around for almost a century. It's been around for many years, and we need to think of it beyond just used for keyboarding or something that repetitive stress injury. And when you think about ergonomics, you need to go and think about how your employees may be injured from poor work rules. And the most common one are musculoskeletal disorders, or MSDs. And these are injuries to the muscles, your tendons, your ligaments, or other areas to your body caused by improper work rules. Again, how you sit when working at a PC, how you stand when working at an inserter or working at a meter. We've seen people get injuries because they're not following proper rules. And what individuals should do is follow what's known as an ergonomic risk reduction process, an ERRP. Now, a lot of companies, smaller companies, may not have a large enough human resources department where they have that available for them. One of the things that we're going to provide all the listeners to this call is a booklet put together by the U.S. Postal Service in Boston, and we're going to make that available from our website when we post the MP3 in a few days. And this booklet's going to cover all the areas we'll cover during this call, but it talks specifically about the Postal Service tradition and how they're trying to keep employees safe. What is ERRP? How do you develop a good team? Then musculoskeletal disorders, risk factors, the principles of ergonomics, which we'll cover in detail in just a few minutes, and then what you can do. What I really liked about this handout and why we include it with this teleseminar is that the Postal Service involved the employees while building this. They involved the APWU, the American Postal Workers Union. They involved the Letter Carriers Union. They involved their employees when developing it. You should do the same thing for your shop and involve your employees when developing any type of risk reduction booklet.
When we're talking about ergonomics, you mentioned neutral postures. So how do you know what those are? How do you find those?
Well, there are 10 different principles, and the very first one is to use neutral postures. And a neutral posture is that position that's going to provide you the most strength. It's going to allow you to use the best muscles to do something, allow you to maintain the most control over your body and the material you're dealing with, and at the same time ensure that you have the least amount of stress on your joints and your soft tissue. So you need to make sure that you're keeping your neck and your body aligned. It's your natural body posture. When you have to stand for a long period of time, you want to make sure you're not hunched over, that you're standing up straight. That good posture is not there just because your mom told you to stand up straight. It's because that will allow you to maintain that posture for the longest period of time with the least amount of stress to your body. So keeping your neck and body aligned is the first part of neutral posture or neutral position, and then going forward, what allows you to use the strongest muscles with the least stress on your joints and soft tissue.
What are some of the ways that someone can reduce unnecessary force?
The first part of reducing unnecessary force is you want to avoid any very high lifts or any very low lifts. That's why you want to use assistant devices, whether that's a dolly, a scissors lift, other types of material handling devices that allow you to push something out without using your body. That's the first part of reducing unnecessary force. You want to reduce the amount of pulling that you need to do. If you ever go to a BMC, you'll see that people push the cages of mail. They never pull those cages because that's going to put more force on your body. You want to limit the amount of twisting that someone does. So in other words, you want to teach people not to like reach over and twist their body to reach for something, but actually move their entire body over. And the same thing with reaching. You don't want someone to overextend their arms or overextend their legs when doing their work. That's the first part of reducing unnecessary stress. The next part, as I talked about, is you want to reinforce the use of any type of lift assist, whether that's a scissors lift, a forklift, a dolly, whatever. You want to make sure people understand how to use a correct power grip, which is how to grasp something with your hands the best possible way. You want to make sure people slide whenever they can instead of lifting and moving something. We're going to talk later about wheels. That becomes more important. Whenever somebody's lifting something of any significant weight, and I call that 5 pounds, when they're lifting it from the ground, to use two hands. And you're thinking, well, I can lift more than 5 pounds. Sure you can, but when you're lifting from the ground, that can put unnecessary force on your back. And when you do have to lift something with your hands, you want to keep those objects as close as possible to the body. When you do that, you allow your body to stay aligned, and you maximize the use of the strongest parts of your legs, your arms, and the least amount of stress on your lower back.
One of the other principles that you mentioned is keeping work at the proper height. Establishing that sounds easy, but not everyone is the same height. So how do you implement something that works for everyone?
And that's true, Barb. People are of different heights, and sometimes significantly. I ran a mail center in Boston, and the manager was probably 6'2", and we had a machine operator that was probably, 5 feet tall. So, how do I balance that? The first thing is, what's the average height of your employees? Are most of your employees 5'5" or under? Or are most of your employees 5'8" or taller? Not the average for the United States, but the average for your employees. And in most cases, you want to design towards the shorter people who work for you while avoiding extremes. So, for example, if you do have employees from that range that I talked about earlier, you don't want everything down to where it's, you know, below a 5 foot person's reach, because then that person who's 6 feet tall has an entire 12 to 14 inches that they have to compensate for. So you're going to avoid the extreme, but still it's easier for a person to reach down and it's safer than it is for a person to reach up. So you want to design towards the shorter people, the shorter average that works for you. You want to make sure that any tables and work surfaces are at elbow height when you stand at them. That's the easiest way to describe it. Not 36 inches, not 40 inches. When your average employee stands at a table, is it at elbow height? That's why most of the furniture you buy today actually can be adjusted for height. That's really important. You also want to consider complete exceptions to that rule. In other words, every heavy object should be stored lower, because that allows you to use those assists that we talked about earlier, and it reduces the amount of stress on the body, and it's safer. If a heavy object is low and it drops, there's less damage. And then, of course, any lighter objects, you're going to want to store or sort at higher levels, because, again, if something does happen and it falls, it's the safest place for your employees.
Sorting mail is very repetitive. What are some of the ways to reduce the repetitive motions?
And this is something that I take a personal interest in, because, as many people know, my dad was a postal clerk, and he started in the late 1950s and worked through the 60s and 70s. And back then, there really wasn't as much emphasis on good ergonomics. And because of that, now that he's in his 80s, he's feeling the impact of all that repetitive motion from 20, 30, even 40 years ago. So this is something that managers need to consider when designing their workflow and designing their mail center for their employees. First step, reduce the amount of rework. In other words, are you touching a piece of mail 2, 3, 4 times when you're trying to process it? Learn to touch it once. Touch a piece of mail, sort it, meter it, tray it once. Try not to handle it multiple times. You want to make sure that you reinforce the proper heights that we talked about earlier, that people aren't overextending. If you look at, for example, you're setting up a case of mail that people are sorting at, you know, make sure that they aren't sorting to the upper far right-hand corner on a regular basis so that they're extending their arm up considerably. Design it so that the departments that get the most amount of mail, they're right in front of that employee, or they're slightly to the bottom. You know, make it easy for the most amount of work going to the easiest place to reach. You also want to break up the work. In other words, perhaps people sort mail for a half hour and then they go deliver mail. Or they're metering for an hour and then you have them stop and tray the mail and bring it over to the next area. Just taking those brief breaks will do tremendous work as far as relieving them from stress and allowing their body basically what I would call a quick recovery from what just occurred. Again, going back to my dad, he literally would work a case of mail for 2, 3, 4 hours straight. You know, there were no sorting machines. The sorting machines were clerks, and they didn't allow them to take regular breaks. So it's really important that you break up the work. I'm not saying give your employees breaks, but have them go do something different, and that will reduce the amount of stress that any repetitive motion puts on their body.
Strains, fatigue, and stress tend to be typical in a mail center environment. What do you suggest to address each of these areas of concern?
Well, the first part is stretching. You know, getting your employees to get in the habit of stretching before work. Make sure that when they're taking their breaks, that they're stretching out, that they're, you know, releasing the stress that's built up over time. And make sure that they're maintaining proper posture while they're working at the mail station. Again, whether that's a meter, an inserter, or sorting mail. You don't want to nag your employees, but you do want to reinforce what good posture is. That will help reduce the strains and reduce the fatigue on the employees. You want to minimize contact stress. Now, contact stress is caused by when the body is touching equipment or other surfaces. So it may be, you know, pushing the mail cart, pulling down, you know, envelopes, whatever it is that that person's doing, or perhaps, you know, they have to key information on the meter. Make sure that the equipment is positioned properly and that the operator is positioned properly in front of the machine so that you minimize that contact stress. And the biggest area of contact stress is your feet. Our employees are standing up most of the time, and so their feet are constantly in contact with the ground. You want to reinforce that they have proper footwear. You know, they shouldn't be wearing, you know, Johnson & Murphy dress shoes if they're going to be standing up all day. They should be wearing comfortable, proper shoes. You want to use anti-fatigue mats whenever possible. You know, allow employees that extra cushion. And, you know, in our industry, we've constantly looked at anti-fatigue mats made out of rubber. I was watching a TV show a little while ago that was profiling changes that car manufacturers are making to make their lines even more ergonomically efficient. And they're using actually wooden floor base, you know, like Pergo or something like that, in place of the rubber anti-fatigue mats. It's actually even easier to stand on. It has greater give and greater bounce back than rubber does, and it's really helped the employees a lot. So, you know, consider not just the standards that we use in the industry. Perhaps think outside the box, and is there another material you can use that they're going to stand on?
One of your 10 principles and concepts was provide clearance. What do you mean by that?
For this, we mean clearance for your people and for your equipment. Remember when we were talking about heights earlier, you asked about heights, and I said, you know, design for the smaller people. However, with clearance, you need to make sure you design for the larger people. If you have to have clearance around a machine, you know, the standard is 3 feet. You want to make sure it's 3 feet. If you have a technician that's a larger person, you want to make sure they can comfortably get to all areas of that machine without being wedged in between a wall, that they can bend over and have plenty of room to do their work. You also have to make sure that any pathways that you have in your mail center or out on the floor, if you are responsible for delivering internal mail, you want to make sure that the pathways that your carts are going to go are large enough for those carts. Are they going to use cages? Are they going to use dollies? Are they going to use any other type of equipment? Is there enough room for them to easily go through that they're not going to hit cubes, they're not going to hit walls? You want to make sure that all the pathways are clear enough, not just in your work area, but any area where your employees are going to be moving work.
Another principle was move, exercise, and stretch. Isn't there enough movement and exercise working in the mail center? I mean, we move the APCs, pick up mail tubs and trays, and sort mail. So are you talking about something different here?
Oh, yeah. We do move a lot in mail centers, but is it always the healthiest movement? Many of our movements are not exactly natural. I mean, we have to do what we have to do. I don't think man was designed by nature to sort mail. So we need to make sure that we're supplementing that work with more natural work and healthier movement, healthier exercise, and healthier stretching. I can't overemphasize that they, again, take regular breaks to flex and to stretch. You want to make sure your employees warm up and that they stretch before they starting work. I think I shared with you a client I visit recently, they've worked with their employees, they've worked with the union, and they've worked with human resources, and they've developed a stretching routine for their employees. And they go through this stretching routine before every shift. This is for the people who process inbound mail and the people who process outbound mail. It's the start of every shift. After they do their daily huddle and they go through what employees need to know for that shift, they then go through the stretching routine. And that stretching is for all employees, including supervisors. In fact, I find out they even include consultants. I had to do that stretching. And as a person who likes to try to stay in somewhat shape, I found it not just helpful from a personal point of view, but really helpful to connect with the customer. So warm up and stretch before you're starting work. And that's both on the inbound side and the outbound side.
And just to add to that, too, stretching and even doing that exercising throughout the day, you know, maybe you just break up your day. That's another option that people can do.
Absolutely. You want to make sure that if the employees aren't doing it on their own, Barb, that's a great idea, that perhaps you do a midday huddle and make sure that they're all stretching. Great idea.
The last principle and concept you mentioned on the slides was to pay attention to the environment. Tell us more about what this refers to when designing a mail center.
When you're designing a mail center, we have to remember we're working with paper. So the very first part of the environment we need to consider is heat and humidity, because that impacts the material we're working with. And again, that's both inbound and outbound mail. Most of our clients now with the inbound mail, they're using some type of automated process and scanning afterwards. So high heat and high humidity will impact paper curl. On the outbound side, especially on printing and automated inserting, that heat and humidity has a lot of impact. And, of course, heat and humidity impacts your employees as well. I don't want to minimize that, but first and foremost for that is for the paper that we're working with. Next is noise level. I mean, we're working with motorized carts, inserters, meters, and while they're a lot quieter than it was when I started 30 years ago, it still can get noisy. You want to make sure that you are monitoring the noise level. You may want to have somebody come in and measure the noise level. You may, you know, need to make sure people have, you know, ear protection, or you may put in sound baffling equipment, sound baffling panels to absorb some of that. You want to make sure that you have proper lighting, not just bright lighting, but proper lighting. So is it focused lighting, like work lamps that are focused on a certain area? Are you using LEDs? Are you using halogen? What type of lights are you using to make sure people can see their work and not too much glare? And again, not so that they're squinting in the dark. With your environment, because of the equipment we're using, you need to be concerned about vibrations from that equipment. Inserters, printers, sorters, you know, make a lot of vibrations, and that goes right into the floor. We talked about contact stress, but, you know, those vibrations will be felt not just through contact if you're standing there, but even on people that are sitting. So how do you absorb those vibrations? And then, of course, any external factors. We work usually either right near the dock, if not right off the dock. So are you going to be exposed to weather? And how do you minimize that exposure and counteract any negative impact that that's going to have on your operation?
And for our listeners, when you talk about the noise level and having it tested, if you're not familiar with what an acceptable decibel reading is for employees, you can always check the OSHA website because we want to make sure that we are OSHA compliant at least.
That's right. You want to make sure you're OSHA compliant, and a lot of states and municipalities have even higher restrictions than OSHA. That's a good point, Barb.
What are the safety and security measures that we need to take into consideration, and must they all be included?
Can I answer the second part of that question first? Yes. Everything we're going to talk about here should be included, and in my opinion, when you're talking about the safety and security of your operation, there's no excuses that I'll allow you to consider. So first, let's talk about safety. And I've had the pleasure of working with a lot of utility companies as clients. And because utilities, you know, are often dealing with power lines and generating power, you know, they consider safety rule one for all their employees. I mean, you go into any utility company, regardless whether you're going into corporate headquarters, you're going into the mail center, or you're going into an actual power plant, you will see visible signs of safety first. And that includes, you know, clear paths, clean work areas. When you're designing your mail center, you know, we work with ink, toner, a lot of other different types of material. If there's a spill, you want to make sure you clear up that spill as quickly as possible. You want to make sure that any work area is cleared and kept clear when it's not being worked on. You know, that's going to keep your employees safe. And, you know, Barb, you talked about earlier about checking out the OSHA website. Well, what about the other risks? They're listed up there on the OSHA website, but to what degree are you meeting it? And do you even have the right type of equipment? And do you know how to measure, you know, decibel readings? How close can you be to the equipment? How far away to be the equipment? So we recommend to our employees, to our customers, to consider risk assessments. And if you're in a large corporation, you probably have a corporate insurance area. And if you're a small company, you probably have an insurance company. They have specialists who can come in and conduct a risk assessment for you from a safety point of view. Now, what's important is if you do bring in your insurance company and they point out something as a risk, you have to fix it right away, because they're going to include that in your policy that you were told that that was a risk. So if someone does get injured, you won't be covered. So it's really important. I think it's worthwhile because, hey, they are experts at this. And, of course, the other experts in your company could be security. A lot of security folks go beyond just knowing how to put in cameras or putting in locks on doors and card access controls. They're trained on safety procedures. They're trained on first responder procedures. So involve them in your risk assessment for safety. And then human resources. Many human resources departments send their employees to ergonomics training. They are taught what is proper clearance for employees when sitting in front of a terminal. They're taught what's proper heights for people to work at. They're specialists in ergonomics. Involve them. It's a great opportunity. And by the way, since these are mostly internal resources, they're not going to charge them you for it. In fact, even your insurance company, if you reach out and ask for a risk assessment, in most cases will not charge you for it. Because you know what? If you don't have an accident, they're not paying you anything back on that premium, are they? So that's going to save them money. So safety, again, there's no reason for not doing any of these things.
And
on the security side, in my opinion, this is still an area that so many mail centers are still not focused on enough. Security is very important. The first part of security is you want to make sure you're limiting the access to your mail center. If somebody doesn't work in your mail center or have a legitimate reason for being in that mail center, they shouldn't have access to it. And by legitimate, I mean that they have to bring work or they have to come to an area to observe work. There's no reason for people going onto your shop floor, and that's on inbound and outbound, that they don't have to. So that means your postal driver, your FedEx driver, your UPS driver, whoever it is, your local delivery truck driver, doesn't come into your mail center beyond where they're dropping mail. Employees who work for your company are not allowed in your mail center, or they're limited access within your mail center. That's step one in security. Step two is you need to make sure you've developed emergency and evacuation plans. Now, emergency plans aren't always evacuation. You know, we've talked about before in our security seminar how you react to a biological threat. People may be staying in place. They may just be shutting off access, shutting off the air, et cetera. What are those plans? Make sure they're written out and they're posted. And then, of course, your evacuation plans. What happens if a fire alarm goes off? What happens if there's a potential letter bomb, an explosive letter bomb in your mail center? Do your employees know how to safely and quickly evacuate the building? And once you have those plans, you better develop training. You know, it's not just posting it. You know, it's not like you are staying in a hotel room and you close the door and you can see where the evacuation plan is. That's not enough when you're dealing with the security of your employees. You need to develop realistic and comprehensive training for them to understand those emergency and evacuation plans and on how to appropriately limit access. How do they deal with somebody that wants to come into their mail center? They have to be trained on that. And then once you complete that training, you need to schedule rehearsals. The people that I have seen that have been involved with either fires in their building, I got to interview people from the Pentagon after 9/11, people who have had real bombs come into their area. All of those people were safe because they had planned training, and then they followed that up with realistic rehearsals on how to react properly in an emergency.
And a couple of things I'd like to add. When you talk about safety as managers, it really is your responsibility to be aware of all of the different chemicals and such that you referred to, Mark, and to have the MSDS sheets on file. Some companies may require that they be held in a certain area, but at a minimum, you should have them in your areas as well. And the other point on security and the training or rehearsals, a lot of times companies may have that set up under maybe it's security or a safety organization, but that's not to say that you can't actually have those rehearsals more frequently than those that they have under their overall program. So those are just a couple of points to keep in mind.
Right, and on that last part, Barb, and if you have a second or a third shift, your company generally will not, you know, be planning their rehearsals at that time. You better make sure that you have rehearsals during that time for those employees.
Well, Mark, we've talked a lot about space, ergonomics, and the principles and concepts that we need to keep in mind when designing a mail center. But we haven't really talked about equipment, and that plays a key role in designing space. What are the best ways to design space to include equipment?
And by equipment, we are both talking process equipment, tables, sorting bins, et cetera. All of that we consider equipment. And the very first step is, you know, to make sure that you design before you buy. And when we're talking about design, make sure you work with experts in design. Many people here on this call are experts perhaps in mail services, experts in automation, experts in prints, but, you know, and we expect their customers to work with them because they're the experts. They're the ones that know the postal regulations, you know, and we recommend they do the same thing. You know, work with your facilities management department. They generally will have experts in design who have access to external experts like architects. Now, when you work with architects, you know, little warning, make sure that they have had experience in workflow space, in workflow design. You know, some architects can design beautiful buildings, but do they have a lot of functionality? You want to make sure you have an architect that's actually designed based on workflow. And then a lot of the furniture sales companies, if you're going to buy from them, they will actually provide free design for your space using their equipment. Now, obviously, they've built that cost into the price of the equipment. However, you're not going to pay extra. You know, you're not going to have to pay a consultant. Now, we wouldn't mind you hiring us as a consultant or using another consultant, but the furniture sales companies actually provide that as an included service when you buy their equipment. You need to buy the tables. You need to buy the sorters. Why not take advantage of that expertise? Whenever possible, you need to keep things mobile. You know, buy tables that have wheels on them that can be locked down. Use carts. Use, you know, devices. We talked earlier about sliding. Well, wheels are basically sliding things across the floor. There's two reasons for doing that. You're going to have to move material from one place to another. Do you want to have to lift it up and then move it to another table, or just slide the table all the way over? Or you may want to redesign your mail center. And that, you know, we're going to talk about that in just a little bit. You know, this allows you to easily move a table from one place to another. You don't have to hire a mover. Just unlock the wheels, slide it over, and it's in its new spot. You want to make sure when you're choosing equipment that you buy for the long term. You know, buying cheap, you know, buying the cheapest equipment out there, may be the equipment that's truly going to fall apart as well. So in the end, it will cost you more. Buy durability. Think about value, not just cost. And lastly, you know, and this is a pet peeve of mine, people should buy their own equipment. You know, you should not be using USPS, APCs, and cages to move just your work around. That's postal equipment that you should be using to move mail. And it's the same thing with the tubs. It's a property of the United States Postal Service on it. That doesn't mean that's allowing you to go and abscond that and use it as your in bucket and your out bucket at your mail stations. You can buy those from companies, and you should buy those from companies. The amount of money that the Postal Service spends on those white buckets, in my opinion, is outrageous, but it's because people aren't returning them.
You made the comment, design before you buy, but that isn't always the way things work out. How does someone deal with situations when space is limited, but there is the need to invest in new equipment?
And we encounter this often in our business. Clients may be assigned a certain building or a certain room to work in, and they need certain equipment. They need inserters, they need printers, et cetera, and sometimes it just looks like it just won't fit. This is when you have to start thinking differently. I started at the beginning talking about using clockwise whenever possible. Well, perhaps because of the design of your building, you may have to go counterclockwise. You may lose some efficiency to gain mobility or to maximize use of the space. We designed a mail center for very large operations, eight printers, 22 inserters. But because of the design of the building, where the loading docks were situated, we had to go counterclockwise. It was a small price to pay in efficiency that allowed us better use of the space, allowed us to maximize, you know, overall efficiency. You also want to, whenever possible, share clearance space between machines. Machines generally require a 3-foot buffer around them. Well, that doesn't mean two machines have to be 6 feet apart. They could share that 3-foot buffer. You want to try to perhaps nestle equipment. In other words, instead of having equipment in a line, can it be nestled or countered to each other? Think about how to provide storage in a separate area that you only bring material to the floor when you need it. Don't store envelopes in the floor. Store them somewhere else and bring them to the machine when they need it. And then again, keep things on wheels. Can you wheel something out when you need it and then wheel it away when they don't? And don't be afraid to go back to a blank floor plan. Start from scratch. Think, okay, take everything out of here and then start drawing. But regardless of what we just talked about with compromises, you can't compromise on safety. And you can't compromise on security. You need to make sure you're always protecting your employees and your mail center.
You've provided the listeners with several examples and samples in the handout. Would you like to elaborate on any of those during our time today?
Yeah, the first I want to talk about is workflow mapping. It's interesting is a lot of people will start designing their space without really looking at their workflow. You know, this is how we do things. But as I said, it's not just how you do things, it's how you should be doing things. So what we're provided here are the standard examples of shapes and the definitions, so a process, a decision point, et cetera. If you use a tool like Microsoft Visio or Microsoft PowerPoint, they actually have these built in when you're doing workflow mapping. And we've included here some examples of actual workflows that we've helped our clients design. First, we captured just what do they do. So, for example, on page 7 at the bottom, you can see that we just used a whiteboard and mapped out what they actually did. We used the proper shapes, but as you can see from my writing, I didn't really worry about it looking good. We can go back and clean that up. And when you do that, you want to make sure that you use the employees who actually do the work. It's really interesting is that you may interview the managers and supervisors like, okay, how is the work processed? And you map it out. Then you invite the employees who actually do the work into the room, and they start correcting it. You know, that's not how we do it. You know, it's really important to involve the employees in this process. Involve everybody who touches it to make sure you capture it and take the time to do it right. you want to then, after you design it, you know, you may keep it up on the board. If you look on page 8, the top of the page, we started using white paper because there were so many things that had changed, and included that, just left it on the board and allowed people to come up and make changes, perhaps draw on it, make little notes, etc. Then you bring that back in. Whether you want to use PowerPoint, you want to use Visio, you have some type of shareware that you use, it doesn't make a difference. But mapped it out very clearly about what takes place so that anybody can read it. This is just one part of, you know, printing and inserting. And we used colors and boldfaces whenever possible so that people could see key areas, like, for example, a bottleneck or constraint, an area that if this goes wrong, if the answer is no or the answer is yes, causes a problem. And that's really important. It allows the employees to see where something could go wrong. For some of our clients, we included one step further and marked areas where they needed to communicate issues. And that's, again, part of your workflow. Workflow should include, if something goes wrong, how do you fix it? Now, the reason why we talk about this with Mail Center Design is you should do this step before you design your space and before you get equipment. What should you be doing, and then design the space so it follows the workflow? That's the first step. The next examples that we have on here on page 9 are samples of different type of equipment that's out there. For example, one is just a typical sorting area. This is a small area. Remember we talked about minimizing reach? This goes into a corner so that one person could handle all of these bins together. If this was laid out flat, you know, it would extend out about 7.5 to 8 feet. One person can't reach that far, but by putting it into a corner, you know, they can reach multiple areas. And if you look on the right-hand side there, you can see that there's, you know, tubs, but they're not USPS tubs. You know, they're tubs that the mail center paid for. Then below, you see another example where people are using separate areas for different parts of processing. On the left-hand side, you see the worker. She's sorting inbound mail on where it's going to go. Completely across the room is the employee that's metering mail and preparing it for leave. So this is a great example to show you separate areas for separate functions. Now, some of you may say, you know, Mark, I don't have that much space for a mail center. Well, I've actually provided the Fallon Mail Center. This is the mail center on, it says page 1, but it's a very large picture. And this is my mail center at home. On the right-hand side, that's my mail. On the left-hand side, that's my wife's mail. Separated, that's the inbound mail. In the very center, you can see the stamps. That's where I process outbound mail. And we actually have 3 different layers. Top is letters because they're light. The second is for periodicals and catalogs. And then the bottom is for larger parcels or NFMs. And by the way, have you ever tried to explain to somebody who doesn't work in mail what an NFM or a non-flat machinable is? Looks like a flat, but it's really not. And because I believe in security, you can see the little robot right in the middle. He actually has a motion detector on there, so if you go there when you're not supposed to, it yells out, "Danger, Will Robinson." So you can see that even in a very small space, you can properly design a mail center. And then I've also included a list of resources that you can go to. The first is ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act. A lot of great information there on how to properly design space with enough clearance. Ergonomics, there's a whole society based to it at ergonomics.org. NIOSH, which is the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health. And then Barb, as you had mentioned, on OSHA. And they have a separate part of OSHA just on ergonomics.
Mark, you've covered a lot of information with us today. I want to thank you for taking the time to walk us through designing a mail center. Do you have any closing comments?
Well, Barb, I'd like to end with a couple of comments and a couple of thoughts for our listeners. The first one is, remember that a good design can always get better. When I worked at State Street, the very first project I had was to redesign the mail center. The mail center there had not had any work done on it since the 1970s. I had the great fortune of being allowed an architect to come in, and this was a workflow architect who would help design a print center for us. The furniture company got involved with the design, and you know, we spent months, we had facilities management, and it took us about 3 to 4 months to build this operation. And we invested almost $1 million just in that redesign and new equipment. On day one, my employees saw that where we had the mail coming in didn't really work with the volumes that we anticipated. And they just moved the tables. Remember I talked about wheels? We had the tables on wheels. They unlocked the tables and they moved them into a better location. I didn't get upset with that. I was happy with that. That's my employees maximizing efficiencies. Design can always get better. And in fact, we recommend that you schedule time once or twice a year to make sure that you still have the best design. You know, the type of mail that you process on inbound may change over time. And the type of mail you're processing in outbound may change over time. Your design should reflect that. Again, involve your employees with workspace design and workflow management. I go back to that U.S. Postal Service booklet. I think that booklet is successful because they involve their employees. It allows them to incorporate that because they're not just being told to do it, they were involved in developing it. Spend the time with workflow design. They know what they do. It's really important. And don't be afraid to ask for help from experts. Use facilities management. You know, you may even report to the same department. Use architects that have experience in workflow management. Use process engineers and use consultants. You know, asking for help isn't a sign of weakness. Asking for help is a sign of intelligence. So I want to wish good luck to our listeners as they design the best mail centers for their companies and for their employees. Thanks.
And thank you again, Mark. I would also like to thank our listeners. If you would like any additional information, please visit our website, www.berkshire-company.com. We look forward to speaking with everyone during our next teleseminar, October 21st, when we discuss standard operating procedures. Goodbye.